We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives, but can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now welcome your host, Jen Lumenlund.
And welcome to the Your Parenting Mojo podcast. Today's episode is called Do You Punish Your Child with Rewards? I've actually never said the words good job to my toddler. I was lucky and I stumbled on Alfie Cohn's book Punished by Rewards early enough that I was able to break the habit before my daughter had really done anything much that might be construed as requiring a good job. But she started at a fairly high quality, as far as I can tell, daycare a couple of weeks back. And even though it seems as though she's been home for half of that time with hand, foot and mouth and earache, she was playing with her Lego by herself over the weekend. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she said to herself, "Good job, Karis." And the director of the daycare assures me that the teachers don't say good job to the children and that she's probably picked it up from somewhere else, which is definitely possible. I know that it's my interactions with her that will have a far greater impact on her than her interactions with the teachers in the grand scheme of things, but the incident reminded me that not everyone thinks about this in the same way that I do. So I want to take this opportunity to look at the research on how rewards may not be the foundation for the kind of relationship that we want to build with our children. I'm going to be absolutely transparent here and say that this episode draws really heavily on Alfie Cohn's book, Punished by Rewards, which, along with one of his other books, Unconditional Parenting, are really a cornerstone of my approach to parenting. If you have the time, you should absolutely buy the book and read it yourself. But assuming you don't have time for 300 pages of what's really very good writing, plus 100 more of notes and references to explain why both physical and verbal rewards are just as harmful to our children as punishing them, this episode will help you get to the crux of the issue much faster. I'll also get into the research that Cohn draws on, as well as relevant research that's been published since the book came out in 1993. I should say as a side note that Cohn spends quite a few words on how rewards are detrimental in a workplace environment as well, and I'm going to ignore that aspect here. So if that interests you, you should definitely go and buy the book. Now, I'd like you to close your eyes for a minute, as long as you're not driving or operating heavy machinery, and just think about some words that describe the kind of relationship you want to have with your children. Go ahead, think for a few seconds, and then I'll tell you my words. There are really only three words that I use to describe both my relationship with my daughter now and the one that I hope we continue to have as she gets older. The first two are unconditional love, and the third is respect. And I really believe that love is a necessary but insufficient ingredient in a parent-child relationship, and that respect is the missing part of that. So I'm curious as to whether you use similar words or concepts, or whether you use words and phrases like conditional love and coercion and control. If your words were more like mine than the others, even if they weren't exactly the same as mine, then my thesis statement to you is that if you use the phrase good job when you talk to your child, then you're actually aiming to create one type of relationship with your child, but you're using tools that are more likely to create an entirely different kind of relationship. Now, I don't want to come off all preachy here. I don't want to give you the impression that I'm some kind of parenting know-it-all. I'm really not. I just got lucky enough to read a really good book early enough in my daughter's life for it to have made a difference for our relationship, and I want to share what I learned with you. So, here we go. Why do we say good job? At this point, it really sort of seems to be some kind of cultural verbal tic. It seems like the vast majority of parents in the US say good job to their children several, if not many times a day. On the face of it, we probably think we're encouraging our children and helping them to develop skills. But what if we dig a little deeper? What are we trying to achieve with praise? If you think about it, it's a classic behaviorist approach. The central idea in behaviorism is that we as humans don't make choices, we just respond to stimuli. Rewards act as a positive stimulus and punishment is a negative stimulus, so we'll do more of an action in response to a reward and less of an action in response to punishment. If you do say good job to your child, think about some of the reasons that cause you to say it. Are any of them situations where you're trying to mold your child's behavior? Do you ever say good job sharing, or good job putting your toys away, or good job listening? If so, you're trying to control your child's behavior using rewards. And Alfie Cohn's central thesis is that this really is no different than using punishment to control your child's behavior, since rewards and punishment are essentially the same thing. they're stimuli designed to elicit a response. He argues that while this approach is actually quite effective in the short term, not only is it not effective in the long term, but it doesn't mesh well with the kinds of relationships that many of us think or say that we want to have with our children. First, let's examine whether rewards are effective. Say you want your child to clean his room, and you offer him some M&Ms in exchange. Is he going to clean his room? Probably. The reward works. But what happens when you run out of M&Ms? Most of the behaviors we try to reward are behaviors we want the child to keep doing in the long term. And what happens when the rewards run out? The behavior stops. The child is no longer interested in cleaning his room. Alfie Cohn cited research to support his point, and a variety of more recent research rewarding everything from weight loss in adults to rewarding children for eating an undesirable food in exchange for a desirable food has no long-term efficacy at changing the target behavior. And that shouldn't be a surprise to you if you listen to episode 7, which was called Help My Toddler Won't Eat Vegetables, that using ice cream as a reward for eating broccoli actually serves to increase the child's dislike of broccoli. Curran summarizes the research using a fabulous quote from a 1977 paper by John Condrey of Cornell University, and I'll actually quote a bit more of it than Cohn does. So Condrey says, "All in all, the evidence that he describes in his paper suggests that task extrinsic rewards, by which he means arbitrary rewards that are the opposite of a task intrinsic reward, which is a task that produces a reward just by virtue of completing it, when they're used to moderate activity, particularly learning, have widespread and possibly undesirable effects. These extend to the effects on the process as well as on the products of the task activity and to the willingness of the subject to undertake the task again at a later date." It's difficult to summarize this material adequately, but in general, compared to non-reward subjects, subjects offered a task extrinsic incentive choose easier tasks, are less efficient in using the information available to solve novel problems, and tend to be answer-oriented and more illogical in their problem-solving strategies. They seem to work harder and produce more activity, but the activity is of a lower quality, contains more errors, and is more stereotyped and less creative than the work of a comparable, non-rewarded subject working on the same problem. Finally, subjects are less able to return to a task that they at one time considered interesting after being rewarded to do it. The facts appear true of a wide range of subjects doing a wide range of tasks. Attempting to account for them all is a formidable challenge. End of quote. It's hard to top the completeness of that quote, so I'll only say that more recent research supports this point as well. One study found that even though parents think that rewards are a good way to motivate children, in fact, parents providing task extrinsic rewards results in lower levels of intrinsic motivation to complete academic studies. Now, because I neither want to blindly follow one path without considering all the others, nor blindly lead you down one path without considering all the others, I will say that when I searched the literature for the effect of task extrinsic rewards on children, several studies did pop up which found that people can actually be more creative if they are rewarded, both in terms of the amount of creative ideas they have and the quality of those ideas. But a study that reviewed both sides of the literature on that particular issue summarized the findings nicely as follows. What appears to be important is not so much whether people are working for a reward, but rather the degree to which these rewards and other extrinsic motivators make people feel controlled by external factors. When this is the case, intrinsic motivation and in turn creative performance indeed suffer. So when people are rewarded for creative performance, this stimulates creative performance. When people are rewarded for performance or simply for doing a task, however, creativity is not stimulated and is even likely to be inhibited. So I guess the question to ask yourself is how much of the time you're offering rewards to your children, you're doing it to stimulate creative behavior. If the answer is most of the time, then perhaps you're on the right track. And to be clear, when I think about the times I've heard parents saying good job, there's usually no element of creativity involved in whatever the child is just doing. But if you're mostly using rewards to try and create intrinsic motivation or to increase compliance with your wishes or to increase your child's liking for broccoli or basically anything other than increasing creativity, then perhaps not so much. Alfie Cohn tells us four reasons why rewards fail, and I'm going to go through each of them individually. His first reason is that rewards punish, by which he means that rewards and punishment are not opposites, as we've been led to believe, but they're actually two sides of the same coin. If you go back to the research I just described on people's performance decreasing on a task when those people felt controlled by the reward, and we realize that the vast majority of the time we are using rewards to control behavior and not to stimulate creativity, then Cohn argues that it is likely that the experience will assume a punitive quality in the long run, even though obtaining the reward itself is usually pleasurable. Rewards also punish because children don't always receive them. Many parents promise a far-off treat, like a visit to the circus on Sunday, and then use the threatened withdrawal of that treat to induce compliance from now until Sunday. And what is the withdrawal of that treat, even though it hasn't been experienced yet? A punishment. It's the do this, get that situation that creates the control of people's behavior, which is why we tell children about potential rewards beforehand, rather than surprising them with the reward after the fact, which, according to research that Cohn fails to cite, is less destructive than rewards people are told about beforehand. We all get demoralized when something we counted on doesn't come through. Children are no exception, and they, like we, see the deliberate withdrawal of rewards as punishment. Cohn's second reason why rewards fail is because they rupture relationships. Where people who have comparable status try to compete for rewards, it sets up an environment of, if you succeed, I must fail. Hardly the type of environment that fosters teamwork. The school where I got my first master's degree refuses to give letter grade assignments for precisely that reason. So no student's work can be compared to anyone else's or graded on a curve. And when no student can be better than any other, the conditions are set up to promote teamwork and cooperation. But what about situations where relationships are not equal? The parent-child relationship is not an equal one because the parent holds most of the power. The parent probably also wants to create the kind of safe environment where the child feels he can come and ask for help if he needs it. But if the parent is also the dolerator of rewards, the child won't really be in a collaborative relationship. She'll be trying to get the parent to approve of what she's doing so she can get the reward she was promised. And not only is that kind of relationship detrimental to the sort of risk-taking that children need to do to learn and grow, it's also detrimental to the relationship based on unconditional love that we say we want to have with our children. The third reason rewards fail is because they ignore reasons. As with all good behaviorist approaches, it essentially ignores what's happening between the ears, or even assumes that nothing is happening between the ears because people just respond to the stimulus of the reward. The behaviorist says that humans are nothing more than what they do. Change what they do and you've dealt with the problem. But if we're willing to say that our children do have something going on between the ears and that there might be reasons why they behave in certain ways, then why do we use an approach that ignores this? Cohn cites a mother who wrote to him to challenge his view on behavioral manipulation who said, "If I can't punish or reward my children, what do I do when my almost 3-year-old wanders out of her room again and again at bedtime?" Cohn's response was that behaviorist A might use consequences to deal with this. "If you're not back in that bed by the time I count to 3, young lady, you won't be watching television for a week." Behaviorist B might favor rewards. "If you stay in bed till morning for the next 3 nights, honey, I'll buy you that teddy bear you wanted." The non-behaviorist wonders why anyone would propose a reward or punishment without first seeking to understand why the child is out of bed in the first place. Maybe she's hungry or not tired or just wants to know what's going on downstairs. This is not to say that the parent needs to cave to the child's every demand, far from it. But if all we do is offer a reward without understanding the reason why the child is doing what they're doing, we can't ever really fix the underlying problem. The fourth reason rewards fail is that they discourage risk-taking. Cohn's principle here is that when we're working for a reward, we do exactly what is necessary to get it and no more. Most of us have had this experience in our school careers. We ask what material will be covered on the test so we can be sure we will study just enough to get the grade that we want and not a moment more. I still see it in myself today. My master's in psychology essays are graded, and I tend to cite research that supports my point so I can get the essay done and start the next one. These podcast episodes are not graded. I do the research primarily because I want to support my daughter's development, but also because I want to share this knowledge with you. When I identified the research on rewards boosting creativity that seemed to conflict with Alfie Cohn's work, I considered not including it because it didn't directly support his or my point. But I wanted to fully understand the issue, and I wanted you to fully understand it too, so I looked for research that cites the conflicting results until I found a plausible explanation. There's no reward for me doing this, except maybe you think I'm a bit more credible now than you did before. My knowledge improved in the absence of a reward, not because of one. And the same holds true for children. Why would you take a risk if taking the risk could impact your chances of getting a reward? Why would you write a paper on a topic you don't know very well but would be interested in learning about compared to a topic you already know well if you'll get a better grade by writing about the material you know? And once you've completed an assignment for a teacher and received a good grade for it, do you attempt a completely different approach to the next assignment if you think the new approach might be better? No, you do not. Barry Schwartz of Swarthmore College showed that if you're trying to get a reward, once you find the formula that appears to dispense the reward, then you're more likely to keep using that formula, even if the reward is later taken away. Alfie Cohn summarizes the findings of at least 10 studies which collectively indicate that, number one, the bigger the reward, the easier the task people choose. Number two, when the rewards stop, those who receive them earlier continue to prefer to do as little as possible. And number three, easier tasks are selected not only in situations where rewards are offered, but by people who are, as a general rule, more reward-oriented. Think about those summer reading programs that are designed to motivate children to read while they're not in school. Two of my local libraries, which are in different counties, so they have different programs, offer these types of programs. One of them actually says that even babies can join. Children track their time spent reading to earn badges and other prizes. If I was part of this program, I'd probably be tempted to read for just long enough to meet the criteria for winning a prize. But worst of all, the fine print for the program says that all prizes are where supplies last, so the child might do the reading and not even get a prize. And this is not to say the child might not do far more reading than is needed, and some children may well do this. But if he does, he'll be swimming against the mindset that rewards, by their very nature, try to induce. Wouldn't we rather have a child who loves to read for the sake of reading and not to get a badge? Alfie Cohn summarizes these ideas as follows. Do rewards motivate people? Absolutely. They motivate people to get rewards. So rewards aren't a way to build a real relationship with another person. And what is praise? And what is the phrase good job? They're both a kind of reward. Cohn has an article that draws on his book, Punished by Rewards. The article is called Five Reasons to Stop Saying Good Job. And I want to summarize those points that he makes in the article, bringing in research from the book as well. The first of the 5 points is that rewards manipulate children. We don't offer praise because we're interested in our child's motivations or the inner workings of our mind. We offer them because they're a quick way to gain compliance. Children will do almost anything to gain our attention and approval, and praise manipulates this tendency for our own benefit, to get our children to do what we want them to do. The second reason is that they create praise junkies. When you say, I like the way you did, whatever the thing is, or great sharing, you're imposing your judgment on the child's actions. And while I should say that English parents actually manage to one-up American parents in this regard, and not in a good way, while American parents are far more likely to say, good job, a phrase that, as far as I recall at least, doesn't really exist in England, English parents are far more likely to say, good girl or good boy, a judgment not just of the action completed, but of the child as a person. I even read a psychology thesis recently that described a series of simple experiments done with children in a laboratory setting, and each time the child completed a required action, the experimenter's script said, good girl. I wonder whether the experimenters considered the impact that the judgment of the child had on the outcome of the study. Children who are praised become more tentative in their assertions and in their answers to questions because they're so used to saying something to see if it elicits praise. Saying good job doesn't reassure children, it makes them dependent on our opinion of them. Many American parents want their children to develop intrinsic motivation, which means they want children to love learning for the sake of learning, or to love to climb for the sake of climbing, or to share a toy because they want to share a toy, not because the parent is either telling them to share in the moment or because the child hears the parent's voice in her head saying, good sharing. So what we want children to do is to come to us and say, I did it, not, was that good? Fourthly, saying good job can cause children to lose interest in a task at hand. And just like using ice cream as a reward for eating broccoli causes children to like broccoli less, offering praise for activities like sharing actually causes children to become less generous. So the next time you find yourself on the verge of saying, good job, ask yourself, is this something you want your child to do again? And do you want them to do it without being praised next time? Then don't praise them this time. Finally, saying good job reduces achievement. Research more recent than Cohn's book backs this up. One study found that the more mothers used person praise, like, you're so smart and you're a good kid, the more children avoided challenging work in school 6 months later, which previous studies have suggested undermine children's achievement. And research from 2014 found that person praise is particularly punishing to children with low self-esteem, who then feel more ashamed following a failure because they seem to have attributed the failure to their inherent ability rather than their needing to develop a particular skill. And this effect was, of course, the subject of Carol Dweck's famous book, Mindset, which I read a year ago, not long after I started my blog that almost never gets updated. I read it from a parenting philosophy mindset, but what I wasn't expecting was how it would also alter the way I see my own abilities. I'd always thought of myself as a person who couldn't draw. I thought there were some skills that were just innate, and drawing was one of them, and I didn't have that skill. But Dweck's book shows some before and after self-portraits drawn by people who went through a one-week-long drawing course, and the difference was astonishing. I decided to see if I can draw, and it turns out that by gosh, I can. I did a class in a book, and I'm never going to be the world's greatest artist, but simply by shifting my mindset from drawing as an ability that I don't have to drawing as something that can be learned and I'm going to read this book to learn how to do it, enabled me to learn the basics of drawing technique. If I wasn't so busy researching papers for school and podcast episodes for you, I'd probably have made more progress in the last few months, but such is life. The point is that focusing on judgments of the self restricts your and your child's abilities, creating a growth mindset where many abilities are simply waiting to be learned with the application of some hard work, opens up a world of possibilities to your child, and to you if you want, that mere praise alone can never do. So imagine our child just shared a toy with another child voluntarily, or put his shoes on by himself, or brought a picture that she drew over to you. The phrase, good job, is on the tip of your tongue, but you want to try not saying it. What do you do? Alfie Cohen has three suggestions. Firstly, consider saying nothing. You don't have to reinforce the behavior. Praise simply isn't necessary, and as we've already seen, it might do more harm than good. Secondly, try saying what you saw, without judging. You shared your truck with Susie. Or you put your shoes on by yourself. Or you used a lot of blue in that picture. Consider saying something about the effect that the action has on the other person. Susie looks really happy playing with the truck. That way the child learns to focus on the outcome of her action and its effect on other people, and not on your judgment of her action. Finally, the third suggestion is to ask questions. Ask what part of the drawing your child likes the best, or why he picked certain colors. These kinds of questions show your interest while nourishing the child's interest in drawing. So why don't we all just stop saying good job? Aside from the fact that it's become a habit, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid that children will stop obeying us and that their true lazy selves will be revealed? Hardly. If your child is older and has been raised on praise and grades, then you might have a more difficult task ahead of you. But if you have a toddler or a preschooler, then it may not yet be too late to just stop saying it. In the absence of instruction, children have inherent curiosity and motivation to learn. And if we allow their curiosity and playfulness to grow in an environment rich in self-educational opportunities, and with guidance from parents that doesn't revolve around rewards or punishments, children can and will learn academic skills and social skills simply because they want to, because they can't help but learn. It's how our brains are wired. Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to read more on this topic, do check out the references for this episode on yourparentingmojo.com. Search for Do You Punish Your Child with Rewards?
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. And sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift, 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.